Hello, everyone, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Powell. This is the first of two special programs looking at some of the most memorable stories from 2015. We begin with a story from January this year. Two men were charged with an alleged $110 million home loan conspiracy. It was alleged that they forged documents in more than 300 applications for clients of their home loan company in Melbourne, in a western suburb of the city. Here's Rachel Brown.
Najam Shah from Glen Waverley and Izaz Hassan from Truganina have been charged with conspiracy to defraud. The charges relate to their Footscray company, Myra Home Loan Proprietary Limited in Melbourne's West, which was trading as Myra Financial Services. The Australian Securities and Investments Commission alleged the two men used fake documents to support more than 300 loan applications on behalf of clients. A statement from the corporate watchdog says the conspiracy involved more than a dozen banks,
including the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, Westpac Banking Corporation, St George Bank, Bank West, Adelaide Bank, ANZ, Bank of Queensland, Choice Home Loans, Citibank, National Australia Bank, Pepper Home Loans and Suncorp Bank.
Between 2008 and 2011, ASIC says the men created and submitted a raft of fake documents.
Bank statements, pay slips, citizen certificates and statutory declarations. It's alleged that at least 350 loans valued at approximately $110 million were submitted and approved on behalf of Myra clients.
They were used to support home loan applications for house and land packages, as well as for the purchase or refinance of existing homes. Mr. Shah and Mr. Hassan have appeared in the Melbourne Magistrates Court and were ordered to surrender their travel documents and report to police twice a week. The offence of conspiracy to defraud carries a maximum penalty of 15 years jail. There have been a number of prosecutions in recent months regarding mortgage fraud. Gerard Brody from the Consumer Action Law Centre in Melbourne explains the actions the big banks might take from here.
One of the issues if a consumer does receive a loan on a fraudulent basis is that they may not have been able to afford the loan in the first place. And that might mean they're having trouble repaying the loan. And if they are in that situation, in significant arrears, then a bank under the terms of the contract and the credit protections could take steps to call in that loan and even sell up the property in those circumstances. Banks could also consider whether the consumer is in particularly involved in the fraud and refer the matter to police.
He's urging consumers to shop around for reputable mortgage brokers.
We do hear of dodgy brokers that say things like, we'll get your loan approved when other brokers won't. Banks do have standard approval criteria, and if a consumer satisfies that criteria, the loan should go through. But if additional work has to be done to an application to get it through, then that may be questionable.
Mr. Brody adds the industry has improved over recent years thanks to better regulation by ASIC. Mr. Shah and Mr. Hassan return to court in April.
Also staying in January, Australian Muslim groups have condemned the use of slaves, calling it barbaric and completely out of line with Islam. The groups have warned the extra funding needed to put into programs into place to prevent young Muslims from being radicalized. Michael Edwards has the story.
Mohammed El Amar and Khaled Sharouf swapped the streets of Sydney for the deserts of Syria and Iraq to fight alongside Islamic State. Of the 80 or so suspected Australian jihadists in the region, they're the best known, and their activities have caused a great deal of concern for local Muslims. News they could be holding slaves has generated disgust among senior members of the Islamic community in Australia. Kezar Trad is a well-known community spokesman.
This is certainly very, very disturbing news, and our sympathies are with the victims. We really feel for those girls and for their loved ones.
Jumana Al-Matra, who heads the Muslim Women's Centre for Human Rights, is also appalled.
From the Islamic perspective, Islam does most certainly not allow for the enslavement of other human beings, much less the selling of them. One of the positive things about Islam is that it actually worked to eradicate the enslavement, specifically of women, which was quite common in Islam's early history.
Mohamed El Ammar's postings on social media indicate he's a popular and influential figure among Australians who turn up to fight for Islamic State. Recent postings show he was in contact with Mahmoud Abdul Latif, a Melbourne man who has reportedly been killed in combat in Syria. El Ammar also recently posted a photo of a Yazidi child holding a gun. The picture is captioned, "He is starting to get the idea that ISIS is a way of life." Islamic State's brutality and extreme interpretation of Islam is unparalleled. Jumana Al-Matra finds it baffling how anybody who has had the opportunities Australia provides could follow it.
It's really quite difficult to understand how two young Australian men, having grown up in this country, can actually take those views of other human beings and then label it as Islamic. I think that many community leaders and other professionals in the area are still trying to understand exactly how these young men have arrived at the situation that they're in.
After recent briefings with US security officials, the Foreign Minister Julie Bishop says she is even more troubled by the threat of foreign fighters. Many Muslims say more needs to be done to prevent young people from becoming radicalised in Australia. Last year, the government allocated $13.4 million to fund programs aimed at preventing young Australians becoming involved with extremist groups. But some Muslim leaders say the community is yet to see any of that money in action. Jumana Al-Matra warns the threat of radicalisation will grow unless it's tackled at a community level.
Unfortunately, in the last two or three years, we've moved away from community-based approaches and getting the community itself to work on issues of radicalisation. And the community's been quite open to doing that work and has done some very solid work to date. Unfortunately, the government is withdrawing resources from that area, which I think is a mistake. And it's contrary to what is happening in almost every other part of the world when it comes to radicalization, from Muslim countries that may be labeled, if you like, developing nations, to places like the US and the UK, where community approach is seen to be now the most important approach to take.
We now go to Papua New Guinea and the month of February. There was a decision to recognise Roddy Batty, an Australian of the leap year, helped put domestic violence in the national spotlight in the country, but not just north of the shores of Papua New Guinea, which has some of the highest rates of domestic violence in the world. PNG's health minister said more than half of the nation's women experience rape within marriage, and 68% will be beaten at home. And he says things are now getting worse. But behind the statistics are stories of strength and desperation. The ABC's former PNG correspondent, Liam Cochran, met one of those women and had this report.
Each night, Lily Jo takes her one-year-old baby and goes to sleep behind bars at a Port Moresby police station. She's not a prisoner, she's a state witness and a survivor of domestic violence.
I feel safe when I stay here. I'm happy to stay here.
Lily Jo shares the cell with just one other woman, but next door more than 100 male prisoners are crammed into dark, dank cells. But the jail is a safe haven. Lily Jo says her husband abused her on a regular basis.
When he drinks beer with his mates, he comes back home and beats me up, using a machete or anything.
The husband was arrested and charged with murder, and Lily Jo offered to testify against him, thinking he would finally be out of their lives. But he escaped custody during a court hearing and is now on the run. He has threatened to kill his wife, and so the PNG police have agreed to lock her up at night for her own safety.
She stays with us here, she's safe.
By day, Lily Jo emerges from the cells and sits with her older children behind the new offices of the Australian Federal Police. Detective Sergeant Michelle Harris is one of the 50 members of the AFP deployed to advise their counterparts in Port Moresby. She's attached to the Family and Sexual Violence Unit of the Royal Papua New Guinean Constabulary and has been shocked at the domestic violence.
I describe the level of violence here as pandemic, equaling something in a war zone.
It's thought two-thirds of women face domestic or gender-based violence, but the statistics are more than two decades old, and the situation is likely to be worse in some parts of PNG. Michelle Harris says change will be slow.
It starts with education. It also increased access to support services for women. Also the increased access to justice for the survivors.
Convictions for domestic violence are rare, but in one small sign of progress, better police work has meant a 150% increase in the number of cases passing the committal stage and going on to trial. For survivors, there are safe houses and services available in the capital, but many only offer two-week placements. Lily Jo is determined to find a more permanent refuge.
I just
want them to help me get a plane ticket to go home.
However, the government department that offers this welfare to vulnerable women is not functioning. A month has gone by and still no action. Michelle Harris is providing support for Lily and pushing her case.
And I think she feels that if she's there at the centre, that perhaps their motivation will be stronger to act faster. I'm not sure that's working, though.
For now, PNG police are keeping Lily Jo and her children safe. There is a solution to her precarious situation, but the money needed to fly her family to safety is beyond her means, and the system meant to help is broken. So as another day ends, Lily Jo and her youngest child head back to the police cells for one more night of hiding and hoping.
Bye. Thank you.
And you're listening to part one of a two-part special edition of Focus Asia Pacific, looking at some of the big stories from 2015. We now go to March, and one of the big items in March was the World Cup trophy. Well, Indian cricket fans went crazy over this. It is arguably the most watched World Cup semi-final in the world, and that was taking place between Australia and New Zealand. It's estimated that more than a billion people tuned in to watch the drama unfold live on television. Michael Edwards filed this report.
Without knowing the true figures, Indian fans seem to greatly outnumber Australian supporters among the people streaming into the Sydney Cricket Ground today, and it's hard to beat the buzz they generate.
Yeah, for Indians, I would say you don't have to ask them which sports they love. By default, it is 99% is cricket. That's why I would say the expected crowd is 75%, they say 70% is Indians.
India's enthusiasm for cricket can't be underestimated.
Hard luck for Australia.
We are crazy of cricket. We are just mad for cricket.
An overused but accurate cliche is to say the game is the country's true religion. Why do Indians love cricket so much? Explain to Australia.
Yeah, that's our religious. Cricket is our religious, you know that. Like, you know, all the India, when it's cricket, we are all united.
Well, they say cricket is a religion in India and Sachin is God. And Kohli is not far behind, neither is Dhoni. So, I mean, it's something that we grow up with. It's something that we learn to love. And there aren't many options either. So, you know, cricket is followed as a religion in India.
Indians have travelled from all around the world to be at the SCG. A number of Bollywood superstars also made the trip to see their team.
Because I know a lot of people who are flying down specially for the match, and they've like made their bookings here for the semis because this is a historic match, India versus Australia in Sydney. It doesn't get better than that.
I found some people barracking for Australia though, but they happen to be from India's biggest rival, Pakistan.
You know, we wanted to see an India-Pakistan match, but now we are rooting for Australia. Yeah.
Right. So you're Pakistan?
Pakistan. Yeah.
And how passionately do you want Australia to win?
200%.
On a scale of 1 to 10, probably 20. 35.
Right. The only thing better would be Pakistan beating India.
Yeah.
We don't get that too often these days, so we'll take Aussies for now.
But while India and Pakistan may be the traditional rivals, many fans I spoke to now see Australia as the team they love to beat when it comes to cricket.
And who's the team to beat these days, Australia or Pakistan?
Australia.
Even more so than Pakistan?
Yeah.
Who's better to beat these days, Australia or Pakistan?
Australia.
Right.
I think it's Australia, but I think Dad think would probably be Pakistan.
Yeah, who's the team to beat these days, Australia or Pakistan?
Australia.
Oh, really?
India won the last World Cup when they played at home. And one thing is for certain, they're not going to be very happy if they don't get the same result this time.
Going to win?
India, of course, mate. Of course.
This past year, one story that did make a lot of headlines in Australia had to do with submarines. The authors of a multi-million dollar commission report into naval shipbuilding in Australia were told not to include the possibility of future submarine builds. But the RAND Corporation and the government have both denied that that was because a decision had already been made to build a fleet of submarines overseas, that is, for the Australian Navy. The RAND report explores options for ship procurement and the viability of the local industry. Natalie Whiting filed this report from Adelaide.
The federal government says the RAND review is a comprehensive and detailed study of the country's naval shipbuilding industry. But there's one obvious exclusion. The report doesn't explore options for the future submarine build. The RAND Corporation, which conducted the study, says the submarines weren't in the terms of reference when the study was commissioned in September last year. South Australian Independent Senator Nick Xenophon says that's unacceptable.
It's either grossly incompetent or incredibly reckless on the part of the federal government not to ask the RAND Corporation to include the impact of building submarines in Australia in the context of naval shipbuilding.
Why do you think the government chose to do that?
Well, you know, I think it's not unreasonable speculation to conclude that back in September 2014, the Commonwealth already had made up its mind not to build the future submarines here in Australia. Obviously, there's been enormous political pressure since that time, so the government is backpedalling on what was already effectively a decision made.
Following the release of the $2.5 million report, there have been media reports that the RAND Corporation was told the submarines were going to be built offshore. But Roger Loff from RAND says that's not the case.
The government at no stage told RAND what the strategy for acquiring submarines was.
So you were just told that it was under consideration?
Yeah, that it was under consideration.
While future submarines aren't a focus of the report, there is a table in there that lists them under a strategy to be built offshore. Why is that then?
If you look at that table, it's been completely misinterpreted. That table is all about options for building surface ships in Australia or partially or offshore. And the quote in times of submarines is there just to fill that gap to show that it is possible that Australia will be thinking about that sort of issue.
He says as well as the submarine plan still being under consideration, there are differences between submarine and shipbuilding.
Although there are some overlaps in the skill sets and the facilities required between submarines and surface ships, they are essentially two different builds. The skills that you need to build a submarine are very, very different from the skills that you need to build a surface ship.
But Nick Xenophon disagrees. He says the report needs to be redone, taking a local submarine build into consideration.
The very conclusions in this report are fundamentally flawed because they weren't able to consider what the impact would be on economies of scale, on efficiencies with respect to naval shipbuilding if submarines were also built here. The evidence that's been heard by the Senate Economics Committee this week and in recent months indicates very, very clearly that to have a viable naval shipbuilding industry in this country, you need to have a viable submarine program in this country where the subs are built here.
That's being backed by Chris Burns from the industry group, the Defence Teaming Centre. He's also concerned about why the subs were excluded.
I think it makes it very clear that at the time they commissioned this study, it was their clear intention to build the submarines offshore. And it would be good for them to come out now and declare that that's not the case and that they will be open to all options that are contained in the competitive evaluation process.
The report found that shipbuilding in Australia was 30 to 40% more expensive than overseas options. But it also found that premium could be cut in half in a matter of years if the industry has continued work. There are currently 4 shipyards in Australia, and some have already started cutting jobs because of a lack of work. The report says if nothing is done between the end of the air warfare destroyer construction in 2019 and the start of the future frigates in 2020, it will be difficult to sustain more than one shipbuilder.
it's confirming what we have been saying for years in industry, is that if you have visionary leadership in government that provides a good, strong, long-term plan that factors in continuous build, your productivity increases significantly. At the moment, we're subjected to 30-month thought bubbles between each federal election. What we need is a 30-year strategic plan.
Roger Luff wouldn't speculate on whether the report should be redone to incorporate the submarines.
That's for the government to decide.
But do you think modelling a local submarine build would affect any of the outcomes that your report found in regards to the shipbuilding?
That has to come from the numbers. Again, RAND is an evidence-based organisation, not an opinion-based organisation. So, funnily, I could answer that question once we've crunched the numbers, and we haven't crunched those numbers.
Another story from this past year that's been getting attention around the world and continues to do so even this past week with a number of reports filed by the BBC. The US Defense Secretary has called on Beijing to stop building artificial islands in the South China Sea. Washington's most forceful rebuke yet to Chinese attempts to assert territorial rights in international waters. Australia's defense boss has voiced concern about the military buildup. Here's the ABC's Andrew Green.
At the Pearl Harbor Naval Base, there's been a changing of the guard for the US military's Pacific Command. Defense Secretary Ash Carter used the Wednesday ceremony to address China's rapid and extensive reclamation of land in disputed areas of the South China Sea.
I want to be clear about our position on the South China Sea. First, we want a peaceful resolution of all disputes and an immediate and lasting halt to land reclamation by any claimant. We also oppose any further militarization of disputed features.
The Pentagon boss went further.
Second, and there should be no mistake, about this, the United States will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, as we do all around the world. Finally, with its actions in the South China Sea, China is out of step with both international norms that underscore the Asia-Pacific security architecture and the regional consensus in favor of a non-coercive approach to this and other long-standing disputes.
U.S. officials say China has added some 800 hectares to five outposts in the Spratly Islands, including more than 600 hectares since the start of this year. Last week, the U.S. Navy took the provocative step of allowing a television crew on board a P-8 reconnaissance plane above the South China Sea. The CNN video showed Chinese dredging ships working to turn reefs into islands and harbours. It also captured the tense radio standoff between both militaries.
Foreign military aircraft, this is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately.
I'm a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
The exchange also contains a distinct Australian accent.
Bravo, Kilo Articulator, requesting flight level 430.
American military airplane.
The growing tensions to Australia's north are causing alarm in diplomatic and military circles. Late yesterday, Australia's Defence Department Secretary Dennis Richardson used a rare public speech to express concerns about the unprecedented pace and scale of China's land reclamation activities. It is legitimate to raise such questions and express such concerns because tensions and potential miscalculations are not in anyone's interest, Mr. Richardson told a Sydney audience. The speed and scale of China's land reclamation on disputed reefs and other features does raise the question of intent and purpose, he added. James Brown is with the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
Australian defence and political leaders haven't been as frank or as forward-leaning as their US colleagues. There's a much more muffled conversation about the South China Sea amongst Australian officials than amongst US officials. That will need to change, and you can see that the talking points are being updated.
Maritime security is up for discussion at this weekend's annual Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. The meeting is expected to be attended by defence ministers and chiefs of 29 nations, including China.
There's a lot of theatrics that go with these kind of dialogues, and it wouldn't be the first time that fairly harsh words have been exchanged between the US and China, but I think we will see it step up a notch this year. It'll be very interesting to see what Australia's contribution to that is. But this will be a particularly interesting encounter. It will be particularly interesting to see how China responds.
This week, the Chinese People's Liberation Army released its defence white paper. In the document, Chinese defence officials say the country must shift priorities from the land to the sea. And it emphasised the importance of maritime security, saying in general land forces would gradually shift focus from defence to offence. The white paper also bluntly warned against countries who it considered were meddling in the South China Sea. US Defence Secretary Ash Carter.
China's actions are bringing countries in the region together in new ways, and they're increasing demand for American engagement in the Asia Pacific, and we're going to meet it. We will remain the principal security power in the Asia Pacific for decades to come.
And with that, we've come to the end of this special edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Next week, we're going to have part two of our look back at some of the big stories from the past year. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very, very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com, all one word. You can also listen to all past editions by visiting our website, www.pcjmedia.com. I should tell you that the only version of the show that is available online is the weekly version that we do produce for our partner stations, the daily 15-minute version we don't include there. But the dates are all there, and when the programs went out, so if there's something you want to hear again, like a documentary that we did use, go there and you'll be able to find it. It's very easy. It's very, very easy. Anyway, on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.